Okay, drawn back to the previous lesson, if you have it. Rocky asked a question in that lesson number 5, and I was back and listening to the tape, and I decided that I must have had a brain freeze about the time I answered it. There's an English statement, English term, I don't know if you ever heard it, where one sounds like a blithering idiot. I listened to the tape, and I thought, that guy sounds like a blithering idiot. So I thought we'd go back and just hit this real quick. Look in chapter 6, verse 13. Writer says, "For when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you, and I will surely multiply you. And so, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. For men swear by one greater than themselves, and yet, and with them, an oath given as confirmation is an end of every dispute. In the same way, God designed even more to show to the heirs of the promise the unchangeableness of his purpose, interposed with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have taken refuge would have strong encouragement to take hold of the hope set before us." The question was, what are the two unchangeable things? The answer is, I said it then, but I'll say it again, the answer is his word of promise. In this case, it's his word of promise, but it's his word and his oath. They are the two unchangeable things that God does not lie. Based on that, we have confidence in the hope that we have. Okay? So I just want to make sure I got that cleared up and didn't sound like I was off on some wild tangent.
His word and his oath?
His word and his oath. It turns out this word in particular that he's referencing is word of promise, which all God's words are true. Okay? Lesson 13. And I want to start not in Hebrews. Let's go back to Genesis. Where we find Melchizedek. Genesis 14. Start reading. In verse 18. In fact, let's start in verse 17. So I can mangle some names. "Then after his return from the defeat of that king, and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Now he was a priest of the God Most High. He blessed him and said, Blessed be Abram of God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand. He gave him a tenth of all." Okay, there it is. That's the whole record and part of Melchizedek. And we talked about, we introduced this subject, here in Psalms 110, Hebrews is where you're going to find Melchizedek. As we enter into chapter 7 of Hebrews, let me just back up and read verse 20 of the preceding chapter. "For Jesus has entered as a forerunner for us, having become a high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High, God, who met Abraham as he was returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth part of all the spoils, was first of all, by the translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then also King of Salem, which is King of Peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he remains a priest perpetually." Okay, I ask you a question, number two. As we look at chapter 7, verse 1, he introduces it with this, one of our stop words, for. So, there's a linkage in here somewhere. What's the linkage? What's the point he's trying to develop or support, if you prefer?
He's the high priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek.
Okay, he's a high priest forever. That's the point he's going to make. Now, he introduced Melchizedek, the high priesthood of Christ, after the order of Melchizedek, back in chapter 5, verse 6, if I remember right. Yeah, 5, verse 6. So that's the first time we've seen it. And he's made another statement later about it, and now we're seeing this. And he's going to use Melchizedek. He already made the statement, he's after the order of Melchizedek. He's going to use Melchizedek and explain Melchizedek in terms that will bring support to this idea that Christ is a priest forever, as he said in verse 20. Melchizedek was what? He was a king
and he was a priest.
Okay? And as we looked at in Genesis 14, and here, what transpired between Melchizedek and Abraham? I'm going to look at it from three standpoints.
After the battle, Abraham blessed Melchizedek.
You're going in the right direction, wrong name. Yes, Melchizedek blessed Abraham.
Abraham gave a tenth of the spoil to Melchizedek.
Okay, Abraham gave a tenth of spoil to him. And there's a third implied thing in this.
He abides a priest perpetually.
No, that's not the third thing. Although he was called a priest in Genesis, wasn't he? He's called a priest here. But the point is that Abraham recognized him as a priest. Saying, I want you to take away. He doesn't say that per se, but he recognized him as a priest. And how do you know that?
Because
what he did, don't you? And Genesis tells us he was. So that in this argument, the fact that Abraham recognized him as a priest has merit. We'll speak more to that in a moment. As far as Abraham goes, I think we talked about this. It all kind of runs together now. What would be the Jewish view of Abraham?
Father Abraham.
Held in high esteem?
Very much so.
I'd say so. When Jesus was talking to the Jews, one of their arguments was, we're sons of Abraham. And they took great pride in that very fact. They took pride in another thing that we'll look at, or not to pride, it depended on another thing we'll look at in a moment, when it came to, I'm going to answer the question by asking a question. If you were a Jew, and you, let me take you back, and you were a Jew going into the land of Canaan, what was important? If you were going to get land.
Inheritance according to the family.
According to the family. The family. Your genealogy was important, wasn't it? We're going to see that if we get further along in this. Okay? Melchizedek is an interesting character, and there's only a little bit of space devoted to him. But in that little bit of space, you get to see a lot about the nature of what God had planned and what's been carried out. In fact, when you look at Melchizedek, just the name itself, what's Melchizedek mean? Sorry?
King of Righteousness.
Okay, King of Righteousness. And the other one is, what else was he called? King of Salem? What is that?
King of Peace.
King of Peace. And so here's two terms that we're going to see in a moment tied in with a different king and a different priest. Okay? There is another way in which, and by the way, those are, you can, you may want to come at this a different way. I will come at it as they are. Those are typical statements fulfilled in Christ as an antitype. There's another thing here that's stated about Melchizedek. It's same as, really, in a way, it's the same as what we just covered. He was a
priest of the Most High God.
And at the same time, he was a
king.
Who does that sound like? Is that normal?
No. It's
under the law? Is that normal? It couldn't happen, in fact, under the law. Again, a point he'll develop as we go through. I gave you a reading, and let's just go to Zechariah. One of those prophecies that helps identify the uniqueness of the Messiah that was to come, Zechariah 6:13. Yes, it is. Let's back up to 12. Then say to him, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, a man whose name is Branch, for he will branch out from where he is, and he will build the temple of the Lord. Yes, it is he who will build the temple of the Lord, and he who will bear the honor and sit and rule on his throne. Thus he will be a priest on his throne, and the council of peace will be between two offices. So it's kind of interesting. You see peace, out of peace, you see the idea. You see the priest and king all in Zechariah's prophecy. Look at Jeremiah 33. Another prophecy we're familiar with. Verse 14. We have occasion to talk about the covenant to come back to Jeremiah as well. Jeremiah 33:14. Behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will fulfill the good word which I have spoken concerning the house of Israel and the house of Judah. In those days and at that time I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness on the earth. Jeremiah prophesied a king of righteousness. Melchizedek, by the interpretation of his name, was a king of righteousness. Back to the typical, atypical aspect of Melchizedek. Isaiah 9:6, we're even more familiar with as far as this point. It says, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest upon his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. And of course, when Christ's birth was announced, the whole idea of peace between God and men was stated at that time was going to come through Christ. So Melchizedek, very, very sharp view of Melchizedek in Genesis, and yet Melchizedek is filled up with a lot of aspects of what was to come with Christ. Now, his main point here are not all the points I just made. Main point here is the one we start out with, and that is he wants to show how here it is that Melchizedek was a priest like Christ, a priest forever. And that's what his argument is, and he's going to use the role, the relationship that Abraham has with Melchizedek to validate, if you please, the superiority of this priest after the order of Melchizedek versus the priesthood of Aaron, the Levitical priesthood. Okay? Verse 3. It says, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning, days, nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, he reigns a priest perpetually. Who was his predecessor? Who was Melchizedek's predecessor?
There was no one. He didn't have one.
I know. Yeah. For the record, for this record, we don't know. He didn't have one. Who's his successor?
There wasn't any.
Same answer. And so the window we have is, here's a priest of God who had no lineage to make him priest, did he? not a priest of lineage. He's a priest by virtue of what? He's a priest of the
Most High God.
Most High God. Priest, because that's what God made him. So his priesthood, it says, he had neither beginning of days nor end of life. Never born, never died. Is that what that means?
No.
Okay, what's that mean?
It's not recorded.
It means it's a priesthood.
That's true. It's not recorded. In what we're looking at, of course, he had a mother. You know, he's a man, just like you and I. He had a mother and a father, and at some point in time, he passed away. But that's not what's in view. It is the priesthood that's in view. And so the point he's trying to bring home to these people is just like the Son of God, he was a priest and remains a priest perpetually, continually. By the way, remains, it's interesting. Steve sent me a note on this verse one time. He sent a note to somebody else, actually, and copied me. And Ray pointed out something about this verse. And I'll tell you this, because these things are interesting to know, for no other reason. He remains a priest perpetually. What's that? What's the tense of that?
Present participle.
Present, right? And there's a love these figures of speech. Heterosis, the figure of speech, Greek figure of speech or figure of speech, where present is put for past. And what it really, in terms of tense, and what really it is he remained a priest continually. That is, he was a priest. He didn't have an end for the record's sake, did he? Didn't have a beginning. He just remained a priest as long as he lived, is the idea. And that's the way Christ is. Christ is a priest forever. The difference between, there is a difference between Melchizedek and Christ. A lot of differences. With respect to this, what difference is it?
Melchizedek died.
Yeah.
Is dead.
God does not die. Jesus does not die. That's the point he's going to make relative to the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood. They had a lifespan. First of all, if you want to be a priest, what tribe are you from? When do you start working? Okay, you're going to get 20 or 25, depending. When do you end? That's consistent. 50. You are a high priest. You are of the lineage of
Aaron.
Aaron, specifically. When do you stop serving?
At death.
You're in the grave, and you're dead. Okay? So there's a difference. And yet, in both cases, in particular, we're really focused on the high priesthood. The high priesthood of priest of the order of Aaron was finite. It ended. It ended with death. And of course, that, again, is an argument that he's going to make relative to the priesthood of Christ and other men. So, Melchizedek, in the terms of this idea of being a duration of his priesthood, okay, the writer opens up with Melchizedek and Abraham in this scene to show the type of priesthood that Christ is after, the order of the priesthood that Christ is after, and the nature of the priesthood of Melchizedek as well as Christ that comes out of that. And then he hits another aspect when he goes on into verse 4. Any comments, questions about that? We'll move on. Yeah, Rocky?
Just a general comment. You probably say it's a lot about the Bible. So we got this Melchizedek and Christ. That's that ending sign. But similarities of the king, Melchizedek, Christ. He's a priest. He's continued. All these things are all similar. And you think about the providence of God. Way back when, there, back in Genesis, there's this man, free moral agent. He hadn't become a king. He hadn't become a priest. And that all happened way back then. And then it's just God's providence on his prophecy. How it all happened. And then it was all of Christ. And I have to tell you, all these details. All these years apart. How God arranged it. And still not violate the free agency of man.
I had a cynical remark to make. I think of evolution, and I think, how things just kind of happen. This just happened, Rocky. It just happened. And we don't understand the providence of God, and yet it's clear when you have the record, God does work in the kingdoms of men. And far be it from me, I'm not that smart to tell you when, what the specifics are. But it is amazing. I just was finding Melchizedek to be one of those stories. Really amazing. It is a very short verse, set of verses. It's a very, very truncated set of events, brought on by a raid in Sodom, where Lot and his families were taken out, and Abraham went and saved them, and he just happened to run into Melchizedek, and we have this recorded. A lot of other things didn't get recorded in that event, but this did. Okay. All right, let's read 4:74. Now observe how great this man was to whom Abraham, the patriarch, gave a tenth of the choicest spoils. And those indeed of the sons of Levi who received the priest office have commandment in the law to collect a tenth from the people, that is, from their brethren, although these are descended from Abraham. But the one whose genealogy is not traced from them collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed the one who had the promises. But without any dispute, the lesser is blessed for the greater. In this case, mortal men receive tithes, but in that case, one receives them of whom it is witnessed that he lives on. And, so to speak, through Abraham and even Levi, who received tithes, paid tithes, for he was still in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. He uses four things. He makes this statement in 4. Observe how great this man was. And I ask you a question about what four things are used in this section to show the greatness of Melchizedek. Let's take it one at a time. Just give me one.
Abraham gave him a tenth of the choicest.
Okay. Received tithes from Abraham. Under the law, it would come later. Did the Jewish nation tithe?
Yes.
A whole lot.
Were they required to tithe?
Yes.
Of course, had a lot of sacrifices, etc., but they were required to tithe the support of priests. Okay? Was Abraham required by the law to tithe to a priest? It's kind of hard when there is no law yet for that. That law is in view. There's no old covenant yet. And yet he gave a tenth to Melchizedek. And so here's a point. He didn't have to give a tenth. I mean, at least I know of no record to say he had to give a tenth. And yet, here it is, the father of the Jewish nation gives a tenth to this priest that's of a different order. Okay? Voluntarily. That's a dimension of how great he is. What's another one?
Just a comment about that, though. Whether he had to, whether he did on free will, it still set a hierarchy. That Abraham recognized that this individual, Melchizedek, was worthy of receiving a tithe. Right?
Yeah, he valued the office, is the way of describing it. Valued the priestly office.
It wasn't even an issue in Genesis. It happened because it should happen.
We don't have the details of the background, but yes, you right. Good point.
I think Melchizedek blessed Abraham.
Okay, he blessed Melchizedek, blessed Abraham, and of course Abraham had received the promises that had been in view all throughout this section.
And it just goes, in fact, the way the writer puts this, it kind of goes without saying, verse 7. But without any dispute, the lesser is blessed by the greater. So where does this put Melchizedek vis-a-vis Abraham?
He is the greater thing.
It's the greater, okay? Greater than Abraham. Whoa, you're a Jew? That ought to kick you back on your heels a bit. Think about it. Give me another one.
He was a priest.
Okay, he was a priest. I thought I wrote my question. Okay, it's sure. That does show something above and beyond the common man, didn't it? Wasn't one I was thinking of.
Were you after he's a perpetual priest?
Yeah, he was a priest. I had another word forever. Continue. So he was a priest. The death had no hold on his priesthood. In the view of the writer in this point. Yeah. Or if you like, in the scope of the subject at hand. Alright? He makes the statement in verse... where does he make the statement? Verse 8. In this case... mortal men, the case being today, in this case, today, mortal men receive tithes, or in the case of Abraham, Levitical priesthood. But in that case, one receives him whom it is witnessed that he lives on. So here's a case of under this one versus under that one. Okay? And this one is mortal men, and that one he lives on. There's a contrast for it. Made that shows his greatness. There's one other one.
The heir of Abraham, Levi, paid tithes to
Melchizedek. Okay, Levi. Figuratively speaking, Levi. And all those that came after Levi paid tithes as well. Levi, of course, wasn't born yet. It'd be some years before he'd be born. But even Levi gave tithes to Melchizedek. So you stand back... And the conclusion is pretty straightforward. What's the conclusion of all this? I thought it was straightforward. What is the conclusion? What's the point he's trying to make?
Melchizedek's priesthood is better than the Levitical priesthood.
Than the Levitical priesthood. That's his point.
Yeah. We have this. I don't know, I could be wrong with this. I'm not sure that it's trying to match Melchizedek and Christ as exact mirrors, because there are some obvious differences.
Oh, it's not, yeah, I agree.
The major point is there's a priesthood difference than what you all think about and recognize, and here's the way of understanding that is you appreciate Melchizedek. Have you thought about the fact his hierarchy, his relationship to Abraham, who was your father? And he's more like Christ, and so you're almost backdooring it.
Here it is. He's making an argument to support his conclusion that he's already made. Now he's going to he frames it different to another a continuation of that conclusion. Who elevated the priesthood of Melchizedek, in a sense?
God.
Sorry?
God.
Yeah, God. Who claimed Christ was after this order? God. God's made the statement. And so, if you're a Jew, God has made this priest after the order of Melchizedek, and look how great he was vis-a-vis Abraham. Who you hold as your patriarch, and by the way, out of which comes ultimately would come the whole system of laws that would, or the nation that would be governed by this system of laws that would come later. Okay.
This is a very logical argument here. I mean, you see someone just building your form, and then add to it, and next thing you know, the Jew says, oh yeah.
Christ is better. I mean, you see it as kind of that.
The only, reason I'm kind of smiling, I think there's very little in the Bible that isn't logical. I agree with you. There's some things that are difficult to understand, as Peter would say. Paul writes some of those things. But it's very logical. And I think, at least for me, maybe not to you, but to me it helps to, and I harp on this a little bit, probably more than I need to, it helps to me to think of the standpoint of where the Hebrew Christian, what is a Hebrew Christian's mindset? What's he been used to all these years? Okay. All right. Ready to go to lesson 15? We've got 10 minutes or so. Let's see how far we get in. Let's read 11:7. Start, I'm sorry, 11:7. About 7:11. It says, now if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to rise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aaron? For when the priesthood is changed, the necessity that takes place to change the law also. For the one concerning whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no one has officiated at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe of reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests. And this is clearer still if another priest arises according to the likeness of Melchizedek, who has become such not on the basis of the law of physical requirement, but according to the power of an indestructible life. For it is attested of him, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. For on the one hand, there is a setting aside of the former commandment because of its weakness and uselessness, for the law made nothing perfect. And on the other hand, there is a bringing in of a better hope through which we draw near to God. I gave in your lesson, there's a couple of things I want to do before we get right into the text. I gave you some background reading to do, and that, I hope, well, help with this lesson and continue to build on that as we go through. We're going to be delving into things pertaining to old law and priesthood and that kind of stuff, and the tabernacle, etc. So there'll be Old Testament readings I'd encourage you to read. I want to kind of give you at least one overview. You can organize this section different ways. I'm just, I gave you in your lesson a way of organizing it. The verses 11 through 14 in this deal with the inadequacy of the priesthood and the law. The Levitical priesthood is, of course, connected directly to the law. The law is what brought it about. And it was inadequate, and so something needed to replace it. Okay? And then 15 through 19, it becomes... there's a point made that becomes evident that God had that intent all along, and this is going to be a priesthood not based on the physical requirements, if you like, but rather according to a endless life. So God foresaw setting aside the law with its weaknesses and bringing in a better system. And then in verse 20 through 25, God's high priest is the guarantee of a better covenant, a point statement he makes. And that God, again, established this priest, swore that he would be a priest forever, and by the carrying out of that, he brings with him as well a better covenant, and that high priest is his guarantee of it. And he, of course, maintains a permanent priesthood. And then finally, 26 through 28, this high priest is one perfectly fitted for our needs. It's a summarization of the nature of this priest. And in fact, I made the kind of summation comment. As a result of all this, he establishes Christ's high priesthood being superior. One, because of the oath given by God that effect, one, because of the permanence of the priesthood, and finally because of the character of the priest. All those come out in this section. Okay. All right, look at 11. Verse 11. He makes this point, his perfection through the Levitical priesthood, or if it was through the Levitical priesthood, what further need was there? When he talks about perfection, makes that statement, what's he really talking about?
The law? The forgiveness of sin? He's not.
Okay. Yeah, rub them all together, and they're both right. Look over in Galatians 3. Verse 21. Verse 21. Verse 19. Why the law then? It was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator into the seed come to whom the promise had been made. A mediator is not for one party only, whereas God is only one. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God, may never be, for if a law had been given which was able to impart life, then righteousness would indeed have been based on the law. There's a, I call it an if-then argument, if you like. And he makes it here in Galatians. If the law had been given which was able to impart righteousness, then you wouldn't need to have another law, would you? Same kind of arguments being made by the writer in Hebrews 11. There he's talking about the inadequacy of the priesthood, but that priesthood is established by what? By the law, by an inadequate law. And so one follows the other, really. And that was actually the way he stated it. If the Levitical priesthood, remember we talk about perfect, what's the idea of perfect many times? I state the thing under consideration. And if the Levitical priesthood was perfect, that was the best there was, then there wasn't be a need for another one. But that wasn't the case. And Christ's priesthood is the perfect priesthood in the argument that he's making. Okay? He goes on then, and he makes a statement. This is something we've talked about, and you've heard from the pulpit, you've heard a lot of different ways. If the priesthood is going to change, what else is necessary? Change in the law. And because of what law, the old covenant established the law of Moses, the Levitical priesthood, and it had lineage, it had a genealogy associated with it, and there were rules to be followed in terms of who the priest was and how the priest operated and those kinds of things. And so if you're going to put a different priest in, it's not out of that genealogy, you're going to have a different law. Just that simple. We use that throughout this section. You can see an argument made very easily that about the arguing from silence of the scripture. Here it is that it never was said that, of course, Christ or a tribe of Judah, a member of the tribe of Judah, could not be a high priest, was it? The law didn't speak to it. The law spoke to who was to be. And so, different, it's a side light that you can make an argument about authority out of this section that you've heard probably many times. Verse 16, he makes a contrast between
carnal and power in this life.
Carnal or physical carnal. and the power of an indestructible life. Of course, it's, again, contrast between here's the Levitical priesthood, here's the priesthood of Christ. And which one's superior? Pretty clear. Okay. In 15, I was backing up to 15. I'm sorry, I don't want to back up to 15 yet. 110, Psalms 110, 4, quoted again here, and quoted several times. And I have made the point, he all made the point, and answered it. The decision for God to, or the decision for Christ to be after the order of Melchizedek is God's plan. It always was God's plan. It's been carried out. It's kind of interesting going back to what Rocky said about Genesis. Also in 110, in Psalms 110, it's kind of interesting that out of the blue, so to speak, there is this introduction of the order of Melchizedek again. And then silence in the scriptures for years until Christ comes on the bench, on the scene. The duration of this priest is, you know, he's not dependent on genealogy, but even more important than that, perhaps. Let's suppose you had a perfect, in the sense of flawless, sense of somebody that would, some individual that actually was able to achieve something great. What happens at the end of his life?
He dies.
That's gone too. So, you know, although that's not an argument, the argument is that you have a priesthood built on the law that's inadequate. It does not lead to the kind of forgiveness of sin, eternal life, that God's priest, Epidorian, could bring back, or did bring back. Okay, so we'll pick up in number five. I don't think we'll get through 16. I doubt it. We'll get through 15. And into 16, so going into 16.